Welcome to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. We are ready today for Genesis chapter 42. We have had 7 fantastic years of produce, but the Egyptians have been putting aside 20% of those huge harvests. Because God revealed to the Pharaoh, and this was translated by Joseph, that this is what needed to happen. And so now in the first bad harvest time, which would have been the spring of 1887, people are starting to go to Joseph in order to get the grain that they need to live off of. Unfortunately, some of the Egyptian people didn't prepare well, and so they're having to tap into this supply. But the larger group that seems to be coming to Joseph are foreigners, people from places like Canaan, the Holy Land, where they are also having a famine, which tells us that there's 2 weather systems that have been disrupted. The normal Mediterranean weather system has been disrupted, and so has the monsoon system of Africa going over into India and Indonesia. So those guys didn't have the supernatural memo that the Egyptians got, that it was going to be 7 really good years followed by 7 really bad years. So all they know is we didn't get the winter rains, which means that our crops dried up, didn't produce anything, or produced very little. And so we have seed stock that we can plant again this fall and hope for the weather to improve. And we have to have enough to eat off from now until next spring when the harvest hopefully will come in. And so they start realizing we don't have enough on hand for that. Now, that's especially true for Jacob. Because remember, Jacob is running a monster operation here, a huge tent city. And have all these animals scattered around the entire country, they're going to have a problem finding enough forage. So they would normally be supplemented out of supplies at the tent city. So there's no way in the world that Jacob's family, Israel's family, can make it till next spring without supplemental grain. Chapter 42. When Jacob learned that there was grain for sale in Egypt, he said to his sons, "Why are you looking at one another?" So apparently there's some sort of family conference going on about, well, what are we going to do? How are we going to prepare? How are we going to make ends meet until next spring when we hopefully have enough grain from our grain fields that we've planted nearby to feed everyone? And so Jacob just interrupts and he says, "Why are you sitting around here looking at each other?" He said, "Behold, I've heard that there is grain for sale in Egypt. You go down there and you buy grain for us that we may live and not die." So he does have enough wealth on hand, as in silver and gold, that he can supplement by buying grain out of Egypt, which he knows Egypt has grain. And so he says, "You guys just take some money down there and you get what we need and get back here." But this is important to the story, verse 4, Jacob did not send Benjamin, Joseph's brother, with his brothers, for he feared that harm might happen to him. Now this is interesting. It has been quite some time now, several decades, since Joseph disappeared. His body wasn't found, just a bloody special garment. It seems as if Jacob might be wondering now just how safe it is to send his other son of his beloved late wife, Rachel, with this crew, whether or not another bloody garment, no body, might be brought back to him. And so he doesn't take the chance. Now, Benjamin is, I think he's in his 20s now, and he's going to be kept at home to help wrangle things at the tent city. Verse number 5, thus the sons of Israel, 10 of them, came to buy among the others who came, for the famine in the land, for the famine was in the land of Canaan. So you have to picture, and this is easy enough to do because we've got illustrations from a tomb wall of this time period of Semite people coming to Egypt to engage in commerce. And so you can tell the Semites because they've got nice black curly hair and black beards, and they've got these tunics that cover their chests and go down toward their knees, and some of them are multicolored, and they've got donkeys that they're bringing with them. And the Egyptians are there with no hair, unless it's a fake, you know, wig, and they have their little white kilts. And so that helps us imagine this stream of people coming to Egypt, coming to a major storehouse site that has been designated as the sale point for grain to foreigners, to non-Egyptians. And I can almost guarantee you that the non-Egyptians are going to be paying a bigger premium for this grain than the locals will be paying. Call it a tariff, if you will. So Joseph was governor over the land, and he was the one who sold to all the people of the land. So he doesn't personally sell to all the people. Remember, he's still kind of going all over the place taking care of business. But it just so happens that he was there at the foreign sale point when his brothers show up. And Joseph's brothers came and they bowed themselves before him with their faces to the ground. And Joseph saw his brothers and recognized them. Now, there's a whole bunch of stuff happening at once here that we got to think about. How did Joseph recognize his brothers? Well, how many groups of 10 Semitic guys that are super close in age would show up in Egypt and look like they're all part of the same family? I mean, that's pretty obvious. Plus, you know that you've maybe met somebody after, you know, a couple of decades, and they say, "Do you know who I am?" It's really hard when they say that, isn't it? It's like, what do? You start looking at them, don't you? And you start trying to imagine them as younger, or maybe without a beard, or with a beard, or without glasses, or with glasses. And you go through all these wranglings, and then eventually something clicks, and you go, "Oh, I can see that person in there. I know who they are. It makes sense now." And so that's him. He hasn't seen these guys since he was 17, and he is now 38. But he can see that they're his brothers. Now, he doesn't immediately introduce himself. Now, that's one part of it. Don't forget the other part. He has had dreams in the past of sheaves bowing down to his sheaf, his brother's sheaves bowing down to his sheaf. He's had dreams in the past of his father and mother being the sun and the moon, and his brothers being stars, and they bow down to him. Well, what are his brothers doing? They are bowed down on the ground with their faces on the floor right in front of him. His prophecies, his dreams just came true in front of his eyes. Now, remember what I said last time. By the naming of his sons, Manasseh, forgetful or made to forget, and Ephraim, the idea of having become doubly fruited, the text said that he was focused on the idea that everything of the past was forgotten because of the present. And I told you at the time that Joseph was looking forward for Egypt and himself. He wasn't looking backward to Canaan and his family. So he'd moved on, as we would say. And then suddenly, his family shows up right in front of him, doing the very thing that his prophecy dreams had predicted would happen. So verse 7 again, Joseph saw his brothers, recognized them, but he treated them like strangers and spoke roughly to them. Now, again, we got to pull something from another part of the story here and overlay it. Joseph looks exactly like a high Egyptian ruler looks in all of the paintings and statuary that we see. He's got a very high-grade linen kilt on him. He's got a big, wide gold collar on his neck. He's got perhaps a little beard that's fake hanging off his chin. He has no eyebrows, but he might have a great big wig on that is part of the Egyptian getup. He might actually have some sort of headgear on that we see in some of the portraitures of these leaders. And he's probably got makeup. You know, the dark eyebrow lines and the eyes surrounded by this very black coal coloring around them. So he looks exactly like an Egyptian. And he's also speaking Egyptian. He's not talking to them in Hebrew. He is talking to them through an interpreter. He understands what they're saying. He could speak it. He hasn't spoken it for a while. But he is, for all the world, looking exactly like an Egyptian. So, when it says here he spoke roughly to them, he basically says something really gruff and rough sounding, and then the interpreter tells them in either their Hebrew dialect or possibly some other Semitic dialect that they're acquainted with, where do you come from? And they said back, from the land of Canaan to buy food. And so they tell that to the interpreter. The interpreter says that to Joseph. So that's the process that we're having here. And then Joseph, who had recognized his brothers, but they did not recognize him. It becomes obvious they don't know who he is. And so Joseph remembered the dreams that he dreamed of them, and he said to them, "You're spies." So again, he's saying this in Egyptian, and they can kind of tell that he's coming off as accusatory and angry and untrusting, and it's very negative. They can tell that, but it's not until the interpreter says the words that they understand exactly what he's saying. "You're spies. You have come to see the nakedness of the land." Now, that's idiomatic type of talk. It's basically, you're coming during this time in our history to see if we're weak and ready to be invaded. It's historically interesting that the Egyptians were already starting to be a little nervous about immigrants coming to Egypt from Canaan. They were worried that these guys were wanting to make Egypt a more permanent home for their particular ethnic group, or groups actually, because they were multiple Semitic groups. There was a little bit of xenophobia, if you will, fear of the unknown people. And interestingly enough, that is exactly what happened. Is eventually there were enough Semites in the Delta region that they promoted a Semite leader that kind of took over and became a pharaoh, if you will. But that's later. That's in the history between Joseph and Moses. Here, Joseph is setting a cover story, if you will, for treating his brothers in the way that he's going to do, which is actually a test. Now, some people want to suggest that he's being mean to his brothers, but it seems to me as if he's testing his brothers to see, are they still the same hateful, spiteful people they were when they sold me into slavery and actually had intended to kill me? Have they repented? Have they had a change of mind? So, you're spies. You've come to seek the nakedness of the land. Verse 10, they said to him, "No, my lord, your servants have come to buy food. We're all sons of one man." So that now they start trying to explain that they are totally harmless. They are not scary people at all. We are all sons of one man. We are honest men. Well, they weren't when Joseph knew them, were they? We're honest men. Your servants have never been spies. And so that gets translated back to Joseph. And Joseph said back to him, "No, it is the nakedness of the land that you've come to see." And then they said to him, "We, your servants, are 12 brothers, the sons of one man in the land of Canaan. And behold, the youngest is this day with our father, and one is no more." Now that is an accurate representation of what they believed. They believed that Joseph was no longer in the picture. I think they may have come to the understanding that when they sold him into slavery, it was likely that they were shortening his life. And even if he continued to live, it wouldn't be much of a life. And so they have written him off. There was no way to even rescue him once a few years had passed. They wouldn't have been able to track him down and recover him. And so they're saying, "No, we're telling you the truth. We were originally 12 brothers, one father. We live in Canaan. The youngest one is at home right now with dad. The other one that you can't count into the group here is gone." So Joseph said to them, "No, it's as I said to you, you are spies." And then comes the test. "By this you shall be tested. By the life of Pharaoh," so a form of an oath, "you shall not go from this place unless your youngest brother comes here. Send one of you and let him bring your brother while you remain confined, that your words may be tested whether there is truth in you, or else by the life of Pharaoh, surely you are spies." And then he put them all together in custody for 3 days. So he basically tells them, "We'll test whether or not what you just told me is true." Now, he already knows it's true. He says, "This is the deal. if you really do have a younger brother, one of you is going to go back to Canaan. You know, that's like a couple of weeks' journey. You're going to grab that younger brother, bring him here to meet me. And then I'll believe you. But if not, I will consider you all spies. And basically, a spy is either going to be held as a slave or executed. And to make them take him seriously, he puts them in confinement for a 3-day period. Now, how scary is that? You come to Egypt with silver, expecting that the worst that's going to happen is you're going to pay an inflated cost for the grain that you need to buy. But since you're from a wealthy family, you can afford that. And suddenly you get accused of being spies and you're thrown in jail. And you're left there for 3 days. And you're expecting that the only way that you're going to get out is one of you, one of the 10 of you, has to go back and bring Benjamin, baby Benjamin. Now, he's not a baby. He's like 21 or something like that. Bring Benjamin away from Dad, who loves him and wouldn't let him go on this trip to begin with, back here. And that's the only way you're going to get out. Now, it's guaranteed there's probably a good month of time that's involved in this process. So as they're in their 3 days of confinement, they are facing the reality that they might be in incarceration for a good month. And if Dad won't let Benjamin come back, they could be incarcerated for the rest of their lives, possibly even executed. So that's the situation. That's the reality of this story at this point. Now, Joseph, though, I think during that 3-day period, gets to thinking about what he told them. And he decides, you know what? I don't want to do it that way. That's not very workable. Because they're here to buy grain, and they need that grain back at home, back at the tent city. So I can't keep all of them. So listen to how he modifies the original threat. Verse 18, on the third day, Joseph said to them, do this and you will live, for I fear God. Now, he's using language here that is translated from Egyptian to the dialect that they're speaking. And so from their perspective, they probably think he's talking about the gods of Egypt. But he's talking about the real God. If you are honest men, let one of your brothers remain confined where you are in custody, and let the rest go and carry grain for the famine of your households, and then bring your youngest brother to me. And so your words will be verified, and you shall not die. So he modifies it with, you know what? I only need one of you to stay here. The rest of you should take supplies, because he could have sent them away empty-handed and said, you all go back up there, get that brother and bring him back here. Otherwise, not only am I not selling anything to you, I will charge you with espionage. So he has modified his plan to take pity on Tent City and his family. So what else are they going to do? They did exactly what he said. Then they said to one another, in truth, we are guilty concerning our brother, in that we saw the distress of his soul when he begged us, and we didn't listen. That's why this distress has come upon us. Now, this is a conversation that's happening in Hebrew dialect, right in front of Joseph. They don't think anyone except the designated interpreter understands what they're saying to one another. And as an interpreter, he's not going to say any interpretation unless it's addressed to Pharaoh, or Pharaoh's representative in this case. And so they're carrying on this conversation, and notice where they go. They say, you know what? You know why this is happening? Because we sinned. Joseph begged us to let him out of that pit. He begged us not to sell him into slavery. We did it anyway. We are guilty. We did a sin, a grave sin. That's why this is happening. Now, Reuben, verse 22, answered and said, didn't I tell you not to sin against that boy? You didn't listen. So now there comes this reckoning. So you remember, Reuben had a plan, he hoped at the time, that they wouldn't kill Joseph actively. They would just simply leave him in the pit. And he was planning on coming back and releasing him. But here he says, I told you guys not to try anything to kill him. I told you that this was going to be a bad choice. You wouldn't listen to me, and now we are guilty of his blood. God is doing this to us. We did the crime. Now, verse 23, this is the part that I love in this story. They did not know that Joseph understood them, for there was an interpreter between them. And then he turned away from them and wept. This is the first time that he realizes that Reuben had tried to do something to save him. He didn't know that. So at least one of them was thinking in a more positive terms of him back at that time. But he has also just heard from their own lips that they are sorry that they ever did it. And they recognize that they had sinned. And so he cries over that. He is taken over by the emotion. And then afterward, as we get ready for tomorrow's episode, he returned to them, spoke to them, and then he took Simeon from them and bound him before their eyes. The number two son, not Reuben.